Thank you so much for the introduction and also for having me here. I'm a final year grad student. So today I'm going to talk about using generative models for field level influencing analysis. And this work is so most of the material that I present today is done with my advisor. We'll also talk about some ongoing projects with Xiangcheng and Rachel about applying this framework to the HSE analysis. And I'll also talk about another project with DVH and Paco about building a Baryon emulator. Before going to this talk, I would just like to briefly give you an overview of what I'm working on. So currently, most of the time is spending on doing this field level weak link analysis, which will be the main topic of this talk. And apart from that, I'm also working on using reinforcement learning for designing KILOANOVA follow-up observation strategy. And I'm also applying representation learning or contrastive learning to variable star light curves for anomaly detection and novelty discovery. And previously, I also have some works related to particle mesh simulations, building baryon observables from n-body simulations, variational inference, and building up the gravitational wave likelihood calculation, and also some ML work. So if you are interested in any of these topics, I'll be very happy to talk about them with you after this talk. I am pretty sure all of us are very familiar with this slide, but just as a brief introduction, here is how we perform the standard cosmological analysis with the summary statistics. So what people normally do is to firstly compress this high-dimensional observation data into some low-dimensional summary statistics, in this case, the power spectrum, and then we define some Gaussian likelihood on the summary statistics as, and then we can run our favorite sampler and get the posterior using this Bayes theorem. So this approach has been very successful and is widely used in almost all of the current surveys. But we also know that for large-scale structure, which is highly non-Gaussian, this approach based on two-point analysis also leads to information loss. So I am interested in the field-level inference. So the idea is we directly infer the posterior constraints of our cosmological parameters from the observational field. So of course, because here we don't rely on summary statistics, there will be no information loss due to the data compression. And one way of doing this is this method of the reconstruction of initial conditions with the forward modeling approach. And then by marginalizing all possible initial conditions, we can get a marginalized likelihood or posterior on our cosmological parameters. So in this talk, I will talk about another approach, basically using deep learning to directly infer the extract the cosmological information at the field level. And this approach requires numerical simulations to train on, so they are also known as simulation-based inference. So how does this work? Basically, here I show the flow charts of the two variants of the simulation-based inference. So on the left, we have this amortized posterior approach. So we start with this yellow box, which is our cosmological simulations. It takes in some cosmological parameter. It outputs some simulated observational data, X. And then we use this green box, which is some machine learning algorithm to learn the conditional probability distribution, P of theta given X, using this simulated maps, X and theta. So this P of theta given X would be our approximated posterior. And then given new data, we can just directly infer the cosmological constraints using this approximated posterior distribution. And alternatively, on the right, we can also amortize the likelihood function. The only difference here is we use the machine learning to learn the likelihood function P of X given theta, and then we can run the sampler and get the posterior constraints. So we know that the neural networks, they are universal approximators, and they can approximate any probability distribution reasonably well. So given a neural network with high enough capacity and also in the limit of infinite amount of training data, this learned likelihood function or the posterior function should converge to the true solution. This all sounds great, but this is not really the end of story, because here in this slide, I just list some of the potential issues of the SBI or simulation-based inference. So firstly, we in this approach, we rely on numerical simulations, which is this data X, but our simulations may not be very realistic and may not overlap with the reality. And secondly, this machine learning algorithm, this green box, is still kind of like a black box. We don't really understand how these constraints are made and where the information coming from. We don't really know what the model, what this green box is learning. And finally, the cosmological simulation, they are computationally expensive, so we cannot really run lots of them, and we won't have infinite amount of training data in this case. So in this talk, I will focus on using generative models for simulation-based inference. Here by generative models, I mean that I try to learn the likelihood of this approach. I'll show you that this approach actually has some pretty interesting properties that can at least partially help with all of these potential issues of SBI. And so here in this talk, I will focus on field level analysis. So the data X would be a 2D map instead of the summary statistics. And again, I'll be learning the likelihood function. So this function that I'm talking about here is really a very high dimensional likelihood function, because the dimensionality of X is equal to the dimensionality of the pixels. So we could easily have millions of or hundreds of thousands of dimensionality. So why do we choose this approach? So the first advantage is that we have the likelihood function from the generative models, and this likelihood function actually enables the goodness of fit test to verify the reliability of this analysis. So like I have mentioned at the beginning, in this approach, we train on simulations, and we need to assume that the simulations we train on overlap with the reality, but this is not always true. So here on the right, this is an example from the Camel's paper. And here they are trying to do SBI using the gas temperature maps from the illustrious TNG simulation. So on the right panel, they train it on the TNG simulation, and then they test it on the Simba. And you can see that now the cosmological predictions, they are completely biased due to this different subgroup models in different simulations. Or we always call this distribution shift. The training distribution and the test distribution, they are not the same. So to solve this problem, we definitely need to marginalize over different Baryon parameters or different Baryon models or even in-body codes. They are definitely helpful. But in addition to this, we also need some tests that can allow us to verify the reliability of this analysis, so that we can know when we can trust this result. In standard summary statistic analysis, people have been doing all kinds of null tests and consistency tests. So for example, people have been doing this goodness of fit test with the chi-square value. So it tells us how good our model can fit our observational data. And we also do consistency tests. We verify that our analysis is robust to different modeling choices. So for example, in this case, it will be different training simulations. And we also verify that our result is consistent with different scale cuts or different redshift bins, or even using different patches of the sky. And finally, we also do all kinds of null tests with different systematics effects. For example, in weak cleansing, we look at the B mode, which should be very much smaller compared to the E mode. And if we can detect B mode, that is usually an indication of systematic effects. So in machine learning, all these tests are not widely used. So, but we definitely need to introduce some or all of these tests into the machine learning analysis. So I will just show you that from the likelihood function learned by the generative models, it is a natural extension to the chi-square statistics. and we can use it for the goodness of the test. And in the later part of this talk, I will also talk about this consistency test. So, how does this work? Suppose we have some training simulations. We also have some test data, and we train our machine learning model. In this case, it's a discriminative model, which means it tries to learn the posterior directly. If we have this kind of model, we apply it to our test data, and because in this case, the test data and training data, they are using different subgrade models, we can see that we get this biased constraints. And there is no way we can know this because all the output from this machine learning model is just this error bar and the value. So, but suppose we use a generative model, so now we have this likelihood function p of x given y. If we run the MCMC and get the posterior, we still get these biased constraints. So there's nothing different here. But one thing we can do is to look at this likelihood value and compare that to the training data. So suppose your test data is not drawn from your training distribution, then we would expect that it's located as pretty far away from the typical set of the training data. So the likelihood value or the density of this training distribution should be much smaller. So in this case, we would expect that the likelihood of our test data, or in this case, we call it auto distribution, should be much smaller compared to the int distribution, which is the training data. So in this case, we look at the likelihood value, we compare that to the training simulation. We know that okay, because it's much smaller, it doesn't really look at like the training data, so we shouldn't trust our analysis.
Oh,
We
okay. Sorry, can I ask? Sorry, so to make these green points that you're showing here, from the generative model, so do you marginalize over things like the subgrid parameters in doing this?
So, well, firstly, I just want to mention that this is only a two-dimensional demonstration.
No,
It's
of
just
course,
a 2D, gosh. Yeah, it's not really. But for the real analysis, we can, like, for example, using the map, the likelihood value at the maximum and posterior position, and use that as an indication of the likelihood. Yeah, I actually have some example later that I can show. Yeah. Yeah, we can do more conservative scale tests, or we can improve the model our training simulations. But the first step is to detect this distribution shift, which can be done using the likelihood from the generative models. And secondly, I want to talk about the interpretability. I want to show you that by sampling from our generative models, we can get some understanding of where all this information is coming from. So, yeah, whenever I present my work about this simulation-based inference to other people and show that I can get much tighter constraints, almost everyone asks me where is the extra information coming from. And also, people have been suggesting that if you can get a very small error bar with some machine learning, then you need to show why the other cosmological parameter models, which are outside your constraints, why they are ruled out. So, the generative models actually give you or allow you to do some visualization and get some understanding on this aspect. So, for example, here, let's assume we have some input with cleansing maps. We use the generative models to learn the likelihood, and then we run MCMC, we get some posterior constraints. And now we ask a question, okay, let's assume if we have a larger sigma 8 cosmological model, why this model is ruled out, why this model is not consistent with our observational data. So the one thing we can do is to generate some samples using this different cosmological parameters. And there's actually a trick we can do here. So basically, we can use the same latent data as the input map and make sure that we generate the same realization as the input data. So if you are not very familiar with what I'm talking about here, basically, You can just understand this as using the same random seed to generate this new data. But here we are assuming a different cosmological parameters. And this sample, it is generated by our generative model. So it is essentially what our model has learned. So if we took a difference between this generative map and the input map, we can get some visualization of where the information is coming from, how the constraints are made. So for example, in this case, we see that all these halos, they are actually much more massive, or maybe much more massive. They are more massive for assuming a high sigma 8 cosmology compared to the constraints that we are made. Okay, finally, I want to talk about this efficient learning. Basically, the generative model actually requires less training data or training simulations. So in this table, at least some of this comparison between the discriminative model, which learns the posterior distribution, and the generative model, which learns the likelihood function. An example of discriminative model would be you just train a neural network to learn the cosmological parameter and its uncertainty. It has been suggested by some machine learning literatures that discriminative models generally have lower asymptotic error, while generative models normally have lower sample complexity. So what I mean here is, so basically here the asymptotic error means when you have infinite amount of training data, your model has already converged. What is the error of your model? In this case, the discriminative model is doing better. And on the other hand, the sample complexity means how many training data you will need in order to train your model. In this case, the generative model actually requires less training data. So for example, if you are using a linear model to model this likelihood or the posterior, we can prove mathematically that the generative model only requires out of log n data, where n is the dimensionality, and the discriminative model requires order of n data. So of course, here we are using neural networks, so things are getting much more complicated here, but still this kind of analysis give us some intuition. So here on the right panel, this is an example of this phenomena. It's called two-region phenomena. So the idea is here they are doing this classification task using generative model and discriminative model. So the y-axis is the accuracy, and the x-axis is the number of training data. And then the pink color is the generative approach. The purple color is the discriminative approach. And you can see that when you have lower training data, the generative model actually performs better. But as you increase the amount of data, the discriminative model will eventually win. So in cosmology, because all these cosmological simulations, they are very expensive. And because here in this talk, we are interested in doing the field level analysis where the dimensionality is extremely high. So it's very likely that we are still in this low data regime where the number of data is much smaller compared to the dimensionality. So here I just show you a table from one of our work. So here this multi-scale flow is a generative model. I will talk about this in the later of this talk. And here we compare it with other different approaches of data analysis. And the numbers here shown is the figure of merit, which is an indication of the constraining power of different approach. It is defined as 1 over the 1 sigma confidence region of on the sigma 8 and omega m plane on some weak lensing maps. So as you can see that here, the generative model, which is this red box, actually give you tighter constraints compared to the CNN, which are trained discriminatively to directly predict the cosmological constraints. So yeah, this is the third advantage. Basically, generative models, they are likely to extract more information when you have a limited amount of training simulations. Okay, so I have talked about we can use generative models. We have used its likelihood function for the goodness of fit test to verify the reliability of the analysis. we can use the samples of the journey models to get some understanding of how the constraints are made and where the information is coming from. And we can and the training of the journey models also require less training data. So now the question is, how do we model this high-dimensional likelihood function and the field level P of X given Y, where X is the field and the Y is the cosmological parameters? So in this talk, I will talk about using normalizing flows to parameterize this probability distribution function. And I will also talk about how we can add in physical inductive bias, such as symmetries and multi-scale or theoretical structure into this model to scale it to high dimensions and improve its generalization property. So if you are not very familiar with the normalized flow, it is essentially just a bijective mapping between your data X shown on the left and some Gaussian latent variable Z shown on the right. So this mapping is bijective, which means you can go forward from X to Z, and also you can go backward. And this mapping is also required to be differentiable. And now let's assume that we have already built this bijective mapping between X and this Gaussian random variable Z. And then we can just evaluate the density P of X, which is given by this change of variable formula. It's given by the density of Z times the Jacobian term of this transformation. And you can also sample from this complicated distribution P of X by firstly sample the Gaussian variable Z, and then you use this inverse of F to map the sample back to the data space. So now the question is, how do we build such a transformation for our cosmological analysis? We can actually get some insights from this from some pretty common model that we use in cosmology, like the Gaussian random fields or the log normal fields. So here in the Gaussian random fields, it is normally can be written using this equation. Basically, you start from a white noise field delta Z, and then you just multiply it by the square root of our of the power spectrum, which is also a transfer function, and then you get a Gaussian random field with an arbitrary power spectrum. This equation can actually be understood as a normalizing flow because it is bijective and it connects your model or your distribution with some Gaussian white noise field. And you can evaluate the density of the Gaussian random field using this equation. And the first term can be understood as the Jacobian determinant of this transformation. And the second term is the density of this latent code delta Z. So now suppose we want to go further and model the log normal field. So what we do is we start from the Gaussian random field and then we take an exponential in the real space. So this equation is still a normalizing flow transformation because it's bijective and it connects you your field with the white noise field. And you can evaluate the density of your log normal field using this change of variable formula. If we generalize this this approach, we can actually define a pretty generalized transformation. So let's assume we start with this X, which is a white noise field. We Fourier transform to Fourier space. We multiply it by some transfer function T, and then we Fourier transform it back, and then we apply some nonlinearity in the real space. So this is just a generalization of this exponential function. So you can actually see that in this equation, again, it's a normalizing flow, but here we have some free parameters that parameterize this T and Psi, and they can be actually be learned from the data. And you can easily verify that this equation is translation and rotation symmetry, symmetric, because this T, it only depends on amplitude of the k-mode. It doesn't depend on the angles of the k-mode. And it actually has a CNN-like architecture because this transfer function is essentially doing a convolution in real space. We can further generalize this approach by stacking multiple such transformations and form a very deep normalizing flow model. So we call this model translation rotation equivariant normalizing flow, but essentially it's just a generalization of the log normal field with multiple such transformations and arbitrary arbitrary nonlinearities and transfer functions. So we apply this trunk model to some dark matter or density field. So here on the left, I show some of our simulations. And on the right, this is the samples from the trunk. And here, all the samples, they are generated conditional on cosmological parameters, omega n and sigma 8. And can see visually, they look pretty similar. And you also see this cosmological dependence. As you go to larger sigma 8, you see more clustering. We also verify that our generated samples actually agrees pretty well with the simulations on the PDF, the power spectrum in the middle, and then the bispectrum on the right. And finally, because we have this likelihood function, we can actually use the likelihood function for the posterior analysis. So this is shown in this slide. Here we perform this posterior constraints on 20 test data. And then the orange color is the analysis from the power spectrum. The green one is from the trunk model. And can see that we actually get much tighter constraints compared to this 2-pi analysis because we are modeling the full distribution of the field without using any summary statistics. And so here on the left, I show the figure of merit, and we see that we get about a factor of 5 or 6 improvements compared to the power spectrum.
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Yeah, so I mean, when you do this training on simulations, there are a bunch of free parameters that are fitted based on the simulations. And I mean, in some sense, you should be marginalizing on those parameters. I'm not quite sure. I mean, in some sense, the real world doesn't have to have the same parameters as the ones that your simulations have. So isn't this basically what you're doing in some sense, underestimating the errors due to those basic auxiliary parameters inside your trend algorithm?
So here for the training, sorry, I didn't put the slides about that, but for the training, we are essentially let's see. We have the likelihood function. We just maximize the likelihood function. So you can view this essentially as as taking the MLE of our model parameters, basically maximize maximum likelihood estimation of our model parameters. So I think on this aspect, the this training is actually similar to our standard power spectrum analysis where we use a Gaussian likelihood function, right? For example, in the Gaussian likelihood analysis, we also have some free parameters, which is the mean and the covariance of the of our likelihood function. And we fit our those parameters to our simulations. So this is essentially the same as what we are doing here. We also have some free parameters in our model, and we fit them to the training simulations. So
So
yes,
I
indeed.
guess another way of asking is if you train on one type of simulation, like less than illustrious, you train and then you use it on Simba, then would you get a bias or not, basically?
Yeah, indeed. In that case, if there is a distribution shift, then yes, it's likely that we will get a bias. And the way we propose to fix the problem is to, well, firstly, when we build the training simulations, we want to have as many simulations as possible, and we want to have different subgrid models. And secondly, when we do the analysis, we can perform this goodness of fit test to identify this kind of distribution shift or different subgrid models in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the question. It's a very good question. Yeah, so in practice, we find that this model actually works reasonably well on Gaussian and also mildly non-Gaussian cases. But we also find that when we go to very small scales, it sometimes the model will fail. So this actually motivates us to build more powerful non-manifold models. And on the other hand, we also want to have some kind of multi-scale structure. So the motivation is we know that in cosmology, the different scales, they are governed by the different physics and also different systematics. For example, on large scales, everything is very linear, which is great. But then on small scales, we have this nonlinear effect from anti gravity or baryon effect. And we also have all this kind of systematics. So the idea here is we want to separate the information from different scales so that we can compare their likelihood or the information between different scales and then identify the part of the data which may be contaminated by the systematic effect. So we do this scale decomposition with the wavelets. So the idea of the wavelet decomposition is essentially, it is an iterative process. So you start with some data and then you recursively apply some low pass filters and high pass filters to the data. So in each iteration, your data xn with resolution 2 to the power of n would be decomposed into a low resolution approximation, xn minus 1, and some detail coefficients, which is the high frequency modes. So I won't go into the details, but in this case, we actually use something called hard wavelet, which is the most localized kernel, so that we can actually easily handle the survey mask, which is localized integral space. Here is just a simple one-dimensional example. Let's assume you have a one-dimensional data, A1 to A2n. So this A are just pixel values. And then if you pass it to the low-pass filter, what you get is essentially just the sum of neighboring pixels. And the high-pass filter will just give you the difference of the neighboring pixels. So this is the hard wavelet. It's very simple. And you can generalize this to n dimensions. So now for our two-dimensional images, let's consider a 256 square resolution data. So in the first step, we would apply this low-pass filter to the data and we get this X128. And we also get some extra maps which corresponds to high frequency modes. And then in terms of the log likelihood function, it's now given by the log likelihood of this low pass data, the low resolution large scale data, plus the log likelihood of the high frequency mode conditional on this large scale X128. And we can keep doing this decomposition. And in the end, we will get a sequence of these kind of maps. And each of them will have a different resolution. And each of them will correspond to information from a specific scale. So in this case, we do this for four iterations and we will have four different likelihood terms. And the idea is they will contain information from different scales for consistency test. So, I forgot to mention, but after we do this decomposition, we can use normalizing flow to model each of these terms separately. So I won't talk about the details of this normalizing flow architecture because it's pure machine learning techniques. It's not very interesting for us. So if you know what I'm talking about, basically I just use very standard affine coupling transformation to model this each of these normalizing flow.
Can I ask you another question? Can you go back to this so if you have non-Gaussian initial conditions or just non-Gaussianity, you would expect there to be information in the cross correlation of these different resolutions,
right? Yes,
and looks like here you're not using that, is that right?
No, the correlation between large scale mode and small scale mode is actually modeled in this conditional dependence. So here we have this likelihood of this high frequency mode conditional on the low resolution maps on the large scale modes. So yeah, so basically this is where this correlation is entered here.
But the correlation here is just every level just depends on the previous level. You don't have like correlation between the X32 and X256.
Well, that... So basically, this X32 is a low resolution approximation of, let's say, X128. Sorry, one, right, X128. So when you're conditional on X128, you are also conditional on all the large scale modes. Right.
Okay, thank
Yeah.
you.
So, right, this equation is it's exact. I mean, it's just a simple algebra, so you can derive this equation very easily. There's no approximation here.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Thanks. So we apply this model to some simulated weak sensing convergence maps. So this is ma these are maps that are taken from the Columbia lensing group. Each of them has some 512 square resolution with 3.5 times 3.5 degrees square field of view. So it's a very small field. And here we really want to study the small scales. And each of these maps, they have different cosmological parameter, omega and sigma 8. They are generated with ray tracing. And then the maps are post-processed with some baryon correction model to add the baryon effect. So for the analysis, we decompose it into four different terms, but essentially there's nothing that stops you from doing more. We just stop at the four. So here in this slide, I show a posterior of the different scales. So here the all the different colors, they are just the posterior right from different scales. And basically all of them, they kind of overlap with each other. So it's pretty hard to see. But the dark green color is the combined constraint, the posterior of combining all the scales. And if you look at this upper left panel, you can compare it with the power spectrum, which is the dashed black line. And we see this improvements in constraining power. And the other four parameters are baryon parameters. So unfortunately, for this data, we couldn't get any constraints on the baryon parameters. But this is also true for other models like CNN or so it's just because the map is too small. So it doesn't really have too much information on the baryons. So here in this slide, we compare the constraining power, the figure of merit, between our model and the power spectrum and the convolution neural networks. So the top panel here is if we fix the baryon parameter at the fiducial model values, and then we only vary the cosmological parameters. And then the bottom panel is we try to marginalize over the baryon parameters. So by comparing this to top with the bottom panel, you can see how the baryon impact our analysis. So basically, you can see that for the multi-scale flow, X512, this is our final constraints, and you can see we get tighter constraints compared to the power spectrum and also the convolution neural networks for all the noise levels. We also verify that our posterior is actually well calibrated in the sense that we do this analysis on test data, and then we look at how many in how many data the true cosmology is within one sigma region, and how many test data has true cosmology within the two sigma region. So we should expect these numbers to be 68% and 95%. And here in this table, I just list these numbers, which suggest our model, our posterior is reliable. Okay, so I want to show you what we can do with all these different constraints from different scales. So here on the left, we show a constraints on some test data. So this is actually noiseless data. And here, different colors represent different scales. And you can see consistent posterior from different scales, which is great. And now we assume that we have some kind of noise miscalibration. Our training simulation doesn't have the correct noise model. And in that case, we again perform this our analysis on this test data. But again, the noise model is incorrect. So in this case, we can see that this purple color, which is the posterior from the smallest scale, it is completely biased due to this incorrect noise distribution. And we can easily see this bias by comparing the purple with all the other colors. And as a result, the brown color, which is the total posterior, is also biased by a lot. So what we can do here is to just remove this small scale information because it's not consistent with the other scales. So we know there's something going on at the small scales. And if we remove it, we can still get this unbiased constraints. So here is just another example of the baryonic physics. So here on the left, we train our model on the baryon, on the simulations with baryon, and then we also apply it to the maps with baryon. So there is no distribution shift and the model works reasonably well. And on the right is if we apply this model to the MODI simulation, sorry, we train it on the MODI simulation, but we apply it to the baryon maps. And you can see this inconsistency between different scales in this case. So we can actually quantify this by using this ROC curve. So here, what we do is we, again, train our model on n-body simulations, and then we apply it to maps with baryonic physics. And just to see if we can identify this distribution shift with a goodness of fit test and also with the consistency test. So on the left, this is the ROC curve of the goodness of fit test. And on the right, this is the ROC curve of the consistency test. So if you are not very familiar with the ROC curve, here is just a very small demonstration. Assuming we have two distributions, the red one, the red distribution and the blue distribution, and we want, given a new sample, we want to classify which distribution is coming from. So what we can do here is we have this yellow line, which is our threshold. If it's smaller than the threshold, is from the red. If it's larger, it's from the blue. So given a threshold, we can calculate a false positive rate and a true positive rate of this classification, which is shown as a black dot on this ROC curve. And as we move this threshold, this black dot also moves. And if you connect all these black dots, you get this ROC curve. So basically, the bottom line here is if this ROC curve is just a diagonal line, it means the two distributions, they are completely overlap. And if the black line, sorry, this ROC curve is to the upper left, it means the two distributions are well separated. So now let's go back to this case with this distribution detection. So here on the left, this is using the likelihood of different scales to detect this distribution shift to tell us whether this new data is from the training distribution or is from some out of distribution. So here the orange line is the likelihood from the large scale term. And you can see that it's basically just a diagonal line, which means that using the large scale likelihood, we cannot really tell the difference, which actually makes a lot of sense because here we are trying to detect baryonic physics, which only affect the small scale distribution. It doesn't have any impact on the large scales. And then this green line is the likelihood from all the small scales, and you can see it gives us some constraining power or this power to detect this distribution shift. And on the right, this is the likelihood, this is the analysis with the consistency of different scales. So I won't go into details, but essentially, you can see that we can also use this internal consistency between different scales to identify the baryonic physics or the systematic effect in this case. So we can also use this model for sample generation, even though it's not the main purpose of this work, but we can also do that. And basically, this is just the inverse of this wavelet decomposition. We firstly generate the large scales, and then we gradually add in the small scale features. And here we are just comparing our generated samples with the power spectrum, with the simulations, and we see that they agree pretty well in terms of power spectrum and the PDF. So finally, I want to briefly talk about our ongoing work about applying this framework for the to the HSC cosmic shear analysis. So to perform this analysis, we actually run lots of simulations to train our model. So here we have about 100 model simulations with different cosmologies. Their cosmological model distribution is shown on the right. We run, for each cosmology, we run three simulations to cover these light cones. So basically the idea is for low redshift, we run high resolution model simulation to model the small scales. And then for high redshifts, we use particle mesh simulations. And then we run retracing to simulate the cosmic shear signal. We assume a pretty realistic galaxy number, galaxy redshift distribution. This is just from the HSC year one official data release. And we verify that our simulations, they are pretty accurate compared to the, for example, some theoretical prediction. So here, this is just the power spectrum. And compare it with the HM code 2020, we have four tomography redshift bins in this case. And we see that we are doing pretty well. Well, on very small scales, about 4,000, we began to lose power because we use particle mesh simulations at high redshifts. And these scales, they are dominated by noise. So they don't really matter anyways. So we are probably, well, we should be fine in this case. I also want to talk a little bit about our modeling of the baryons. So this work is actually done with the undergrad student, Divya Sharma. So basically we have been looking at the baryonic effects from the CAMO simulation, which is a large suite of hydro simulations, and it has all these different subgrain models. So here on the top panel, we show the power spectrum comparison between the hydro and n-body. You can see this large suppression on small scales. And then on the bottom, we show the cross-correlation coefficient between the hydro and n-body. So what we notice here is that the baryonic effect is mostly on the amplitude of Fourier mode. The small scale power, they are suppressed by 40 or 50%. But in terms of the cross-correlation coefficient, it actually doesn't change a lot. In most cases, the coefficient is actually larger than 0.9 for S3, and for TNG, it's actually larger than 0.95. So this motivates us that maybe we can just ignore this change on the phase of the Fourier mode because it's just a secondary effect. And here we are just modeling the baryonic effect as a modulation of the amplitude of the Fourier mode. What we do essentially, it's just multiplying the density over density by a transfer function to suppress the small scale power and mimic the baryonic effect. So in the middle panel, we show the residual field between the hydro and n-body. And on the right, we show the residual field after we apply this baryon correction as a transfer function. And you can see that, for example, here in this region, we have this ring-like structure around the halos, which is an effect of the AGN feedback. But then after we apply this correction, you can see this ring is almost gone. And now if we use this framework, all we need to do is to model the baryonic effect on the power spectrum. So we build a Gaussian process emulator to model this baryonic effect. We train our model on the S-trade, and then here we also test it on TNG, Simba, and also some other hydro simulations. And here on the bottom, we also compare our model with some other popular baryonic emulators. And we see that overall we get comparable performance. So we also verify that if we just ignore these phase changes, it doesn't really bias our cosmological inference at the field level. So here on the right, we are just performing this analysis with our normalizing flow on some Mach weak cleansing data that follows the HSC statistics. And what we do here is we take the map and then we randomly perturb the phase of these maps of the Fourier modes to mimic this cross-correlation coefficient between n-body and hydro, but we keep the power spectrum the same. So, right, essentially here, we're just mimicking the effect of this ignoring the phase changes. And the result is shown as the orange color. You can see there is almost no bias. And finally, we have some very preliminary results on for applying this model or testing this model on our mock data. So, right, I want to mention that here, this plot I showed, it actually has some issues. So it's very preliminary results. Here we are testing our analysis on some mock data with about 2 argmented resolution. We also add in systematic effect like intrinsic alignment, the frequency uncertainty, and specifically, just as HIC year 3, we assume a flat prior for high ratio bins. And we also model the Baryonic effect with this transfer function. So one thing we find that is that after we add in this Baryonic effect, we get about 40% of the degradation, which actually applies to both our field level analysis and the power spectrum. And we also find that this degradation is mostly on S8 parameter. So you can actually understand this by looking at this marginal constraints. Here we have the S8 parameter. We also have this TAGN, which is a Baryonic parameter. And you can see this strong degeneracy between these two, which explains this degradation on the S8. Okay, and finally, I want to mention this. Basically, we are trying to build this data challenge, and we have already run lots of simulations. We generate all these weak cleansing maps, and we want to basically release these maps and then host a data challenge. And specifically, we will try to focus on discovering and minimizing the effect of systematic effect. So and this challenge will be open to all the machine learning models and high order statistics. And So yeah, this is just the conclusion page. I think I'll just stop here and let me know if there's any questions. Thanks.
Okay, great. You're right on time, B2A. That's great. so why don't we all unmute to give B2A a round of applause for his interesting talk. Okay,
thank you so much.
Are there further questions for the speaker? Okay, yeah. Yes, go ahead, Kendrick, but you're muted.
Hi, B-Way. First, thanks very much for an incredibly interesting talk. I was sort of curious in the HSC analysis how you included the survey mask in the generative model.
Right, yeah. Hi. This is a very good question. So for now, we are still doing this. So we are still validating our model on these simulations. So we haven't really add in the survey mask. So we do have all the systematics, but the survey mask is not included. So I think that is the remaining thing, the only thing that for us to do. Thanks.
Okay, Anyash, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm not 100% sure how good my internet is, but we'll see. So I have a question. If you go back like a couple of slides when you train on like an Astrid and then you validate on, I think, other simulations.
You mean for this baryon effect or for...
Yeah, for the baryon.
Right.
Yeah, like this one.
Probably this page, yeah.
I guess, sorry, this is not your work. This is your work, sorry, yeah. So I'm just kind of curious, is here you're training on one of these and then you validate the other ones. But then what happens if, can you train like on all of them at the same time?
In this case, you're right. This is just a Gaussian process to emulate the power spectrum. or this variant effect on the power spectrum. And yeah, in principle, we can train on all of them. But the idea is here we
this is
want
just
to.
For the power spectrum, are you saying, or is not this is not the full field level? Or this do you say field level here? So I guess I'm kind of confused. Is it?
Right. Sorry. So here, this is just a model to emulate the Baryonic effect at the field level, and as I have shown here, basically, to model this effect on the field level, we can also all we need to do is to just model it at the power spectrum level, and then we can just apply this transfer function to the field, and this will give us a field level emulator, or the
okay,
model
so that,
the.
Very good. So then let me ask my question again then. So if I, instead of training on one of those simulations, I train on all of those simulations and then kind of do the same exercise, look at how well it does. I mean, probably it does well, but I'm just wondering, does the error get bigger or does the error stay the same?
You mean for, in terms of this emulator for the power spectrum?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, in this case, we do find similar error between the Astrid and TNG and Simba. So I would expect they should, if we, even if we include the TNG, is probably we are still probably doing similar, but we probably are going to do better on Simba because we do see some deviations here. So, and Simba is very different. So yeah, if we train on all of them, yeah, probably we, yeah, I would expect some improvements here. Right. So the reason we didn't do that is because we want to see how well we our model can be generalized to different subgrid models. And so that is our main motivation here.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough. But I think my point is that the fact that different simulations are different, that should reflect in expanded errors, basically. So, and I'm just wondering if that happens. For example, if you train on Astrid and Simba, then you should get, I mean, you shouldn't get a systematic error, but then you should get bigger random errors, presumably.
I see. You are talking about the cosmological constraints here in this case. Or...
Yeah, the shaded region. I'm talking, yeah, shaded region.
Oh,
I'm saying shaded region should get bigger if you train on more simulations, more types of simulations. Do you agree?
Because this shaded region is essentially the empirical arrows here. So I would expect we will do better in this case if we include more simulations, because we will directly train on those separate models.
Okay. Well, I guess I think
yeah.
That would be an interesting exercise to see how that goes.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely something that we can try. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the question.
So just to follow up on that a little bit, like, is it possible to get like a bias in the parameters if you know, if you train on too large, you know, too large a set of different kinds of baryonic physics models, you know, like if your prior includes, let's say, like totally crazy, you know, models for the subgrid physics, you know, would including that in the training perhaps like bias the inference in any way?
Yeah, that is a very good question, I think. So I have actually I'm thinking about that a lot, especially so basically we also see this paper by Alex Amon and George about this nonlinear solution to the SA tension. And in that paper they also say something like for example, if you want to solve this SA tension with Baryonic physics, then you have to go to very large, then the Baryonic physics have to go to very large scales. So actually, if you look at this difference between these two sets of simulations, we can actually see that, for example, for the Simba, it actually go to very large scales. even at KL for let's say 0.3-ish, you still have about 5% or even more suppression on the power spectrum. So I would expect, for example, at least for the 2-point analysis, if we use the same band as the prior, we probably are going to get a larger S8, just because this suppression on large scales. And if we use TNG, we probably get a lower S8. So I definitely agree that all of this analysis, they are probably depend on the on this prior. And this is also one of the motivations for doing this field level analysis. So we are kind of hoping that, you know, by doing all this at the field level, we can actually somehow break this degeneracy between the baryon and the and for example the S8. Yeah, I guess we will see. But yeah, I definitely agree that the prior will be very important. And the hope is just you know, just use a model with a very large and a flat prior, and then hopefully the data will tell us.
Okay, all right, thanks. Jesse, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I have a somewhat nebulous question that I am curious to hear your thoughts on. So I'm thinking about like different levels of compression when designing summary statistics. So like a field level inference is more directly related to like capturing all the information compared to like 2-point functions. But you know, you could also make the argument that a weak lensing mass map is already a summary, is also a summary statistic of like a catalog of measured shapes.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on like pros and cons of like how do you define where you make this comparison, or like I guess like sort of these wavelet filters or band passes could be something between a map and a 2-point function. I don't know. Curious about your thoughts on like how do we define the most useful point where we want to compare sort of these simulations to measurement.
Right, yeah, that's a pretty hard question. I think so well, firstly, for our analysis, we are using the mass maps, we are using the Kappa field. So yeah, in some sense we are already reducing the data and doing this summary statistics. So I would think that well, basically for one of the motivation for us for doing this field level is to try to include all the information in the data and then try to model all of them. So it will somehow give us some basically a quantification of how much information is in the field. And then by comparing that to the power spectrum or the summary statistics, we get some understanding of, for example, how the compression is, for example, how much loss we get by compressing the data. So in some of the cases, for example, for the high noise case, we do find that if we use just build a machine learning model with some convolution neural network, and then you try to extract some summary statistics from the convolution neural network, you can actually do pretty well. Almost, we get almost similar performance compared to this kind of field level analysis. But for the high noise, sorry, for the low noise case, we do see some gap, which is an indication of you know, not being able to extract most of or all of the information. I'm sorry, I kind of forgot what your question is.
It was not a very well-defined question, so I think you've answered it very well. I'm just
Yes.
asking for your thoughts on how to define summary statistics and weighing one versus the other. I think
No,
you did.
but maybe I could kind of qualify that question as Jesse's question. The way I understood it is that can you just do this with the shapes of galaxies instead of making a map? I mean, what stops you from doing that?
I see. I guess in that case, I think it is possible to use the Galaxy Shape Catalog, but in that case, I will use a completely different architecture because there we will have a catalog. So probably something like a graph neural network would be more suitable in that case compared to, for example, here. Because in here inside our model, we are still doing this convolutions, so it's still kind of assume a map or this field level structure.
So basically, you needed to do a speed up, you effectively like an FFT type of a speed up. If you just want to work with the catalogs, then it's going to be much slower. I guess that's what if that's.
Yeah, I mean the dimensionality would be much higher if we want to use the catalog, and I mean there are works about using catalog, for example, using Halo catalogs for the analysis, using graph neural networks. I think that's definitely doable, but we definitely need to think about how to, for example, apply this scale separation to the catalogs, right? But in principle, we just need a different architecture.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Okay. So we are about like 10 minutes past the hour. So let's stop here. Yes. Thanks again, Biwei. So just a reminder for everyone else. So he'll be around to chat between I think 1 and 5 p.m. our time over Zoom. And his schedule is in the email that I sent earlier. Okay. Yeah. So we'll stop here. So thanks everyone for coming. Yes. Bye
Thank
everyone.
you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right.